This is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 6, and today I'm joined by Marina McCoy, who is an associate professor of philosophy at Boston College, and she's written extensively on Plato, focusing on the role of rhetoric in his thinking. And her recent book, Plato on the Rhetoric of Philosophers and Sophists, was published by Cambridge University Press in 2007, and it investigates the relationship between Socratic questioning and the rhetoric of the sophists. She shows convincingly, I think, that part of what differentiates the Socratic practice of philosophy from other rhetorical activities is that the activity of philosophy involves at once a commitment to the truth and an openness to questioning the human relation to the truth. So it's a real pleasure, Marina, to welcome you to the Digital Dialogue.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So I thought what we maybe do today is have a quick overview of the Protagoras, because we're going to focus some of our discussion on the Protagoras and particularly the relationship between philosophy and sophistry that is at work there or at play there. So maybe we could have a little discussion of what the Protagoras is about and the situation and the dramatic context. And then the two main topics that I'd like to focus on are the things that you say about the role of questioning in a philosophical life. And the second main issue is what you call sympathetic listening. And I think that's one of the features of one of the excellences of dialogue that I think need to be cultivated. And we have some examples of a sympathetic listening in this dialogue that I think we could talk about. So maybe just as a way of beginning, you could say a word or two about your book and what you have, what your main project there is, and then as a way then of introducing our discussion of the Protagoras.
Right. So the book came out of a kind of interest in, you know, how do people talk philosophically? And there's a story that's often told, I think in intro to philosophy courses commonly, that Plato's against rhetoric, but he's for philosophy. So it's quite often we get this contrast between the sophists, who were a pretty diverse group of intellectuals living around the same time as Socrates. There's the purportedly interested in persuading other people to make money for themselves and kind of seen as selfish and maybe non-intellectual in certain regards. And then, you know, Plato, who's a philosopher, and Socrates, who's his heroic philosopher. But I was really interested in places where those contrasts fell apart and ways in which Socrates is a lot more rhetorical than he is sometimes given credit for, although I think there's more and more awareness of that. Yeah.
I really like the way that the book challenges that sort of caricature of the relationship between the philosopher and the sophist. And I think one of the things I'm interested in thinking more about, and your book helps me do that, is not only the way that Socrates uses rhetoric, but also that this kind of this caricature between philosophy and sophistry is too simplistically drawn often.
Right, and I think it's something, you know, that really I think came to mind teaching it, because a lot of students, when they first read Socrates, say, this guy's a jerk, you know? He's cornering people with his arguments. He doesn't see, you know, they may not be able to pinpoint logically what isn't functioning on a first read, but they say something seems a little bit amiss. Mm-hmm. And Adamantus says that in the Republic. He says, Socrates, talking to you is like playing checkers with someone who's really talented, and you get yourself cornered, you don't know how it ever happened.
Right.
And so I wanted to take that seriously, you know, that Plato himself writes that into his dialogues about the character Socrates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now let's talk a little bit about what's happening in the Protagoras and why you focused on the Protagoras as one of the chapters of your book.
Right. So I thought the Protagoras was an interesting discussion because it almost breaks down completely. And to some extent, there is a very different approach that Protagoras and Socrates seem to take in the dialogue. And I wanted to really look at that. And I wanted to look at that in light of the fact that Protagoras historically seems to have been a pretty serious intellectual. Mm-hmm. So if we look at other dialogues with Theaetetus, you know, he considered the nature of truth and tried to look at relativism as a kind of serious intellectual proposition. And so I was interested in seeing, like, well, is there a way that we can use the Protagoras to differentiate the two of them? The Protagoras is a pretty complex dialogue. I mean, it starts off with a little bit of a comedy where Socrates is talking to a friend and says, you know, the friend says, well, where have you been? You know, you must have been chasing after the good-looking Alcibiades. Right. And he says, no, I was with someone more beautiful, Protagoras, who's this really old guy who, you know, sort of like saying I was after Margaret Thatcher. Or so, you know, it starts off as kind of comedic bit. It moves to a young man who wants to give away all of his own money and all of his friends' money to go study with Protagoras. And Socrates, who's, I think, trying to moderate Hippocrates and wants to show him what Protagoras is and isn't about.
Right.
But in the midst of that, there's all kinds of interesting topics raised. And one of the topics raised is, how do we question? How do we ask questions? What does it mean to be a questioner?
Exactly. And I mean, one of the things that draws me to this dialogue is that, I mean, as you point out, that Protagoras, in a certain way, you might consider that this is one of the few dialogues where Socrates is actually talking with his intellectual equal. Of course, we have the Parmenides too, but right. You know, you often have Socrates talking to these young people around Athens who are maybe not as intellectually sophisticated as he is. But here, you definitely have him talking to someone who he himself says is an expert, and it's actually interesting, maybe related to the points we want to make today, to think about how Socrates characterizes Protagoras as. And I'm looking now at lines, I guess, 329 B, where, and this is going to go to this point about to your point about attentive or sympathetic listening, that he's said to be not only someone who's capable of giving long speeches and great speeches, but capable of giving precise answers when he's asked particular questions, and of asking questions himself and having the patience to consider the replies. And that's where I think you were drawing this point about sympathetic questioning, although I think you have some skepticism about how good a listener Protagoras is.
Right, yeah.
And Socrates then says, a rare package of talents. So maybe we could talk a little bit about the nature, or how you're understanding the importance of questioning as a philosophical activity, or as a core to the activity of the philosophical life.
Right. So, I mean, I think the interesting thing is that Socrates asks questions as a way of being philosophical. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that partly is that often in contemporary philosophical writing and speaking, we tend to think about the answer to the question as what embodies being a philosopher, right? So you might ask questions, but they're really a means to reaching a particular end, an answer to the question, and then you're going to present that answer.
Right.
And I think there's something about the question itself that is more central than even specific answers that one gets in the way Socrates understands questioning. So a couple of things are important about questioning. First of all, questioning requires at least two people being involved. And I think Socrates sees philosophy as an inherently social activity. And we can talk more about what that is and why that is. I think also he sees questioning and answering as a way of being able to be self-critical, to listen to other people, to be open, to striving more closer to the truth.
Right.
And it also is a way of acknowledging a lack. You know, it's a way of acknowledging that I lack something. When I ask a question, I think there's something more to be discovered about the question. I don't think I've already mastered it.
So, and I mean, do you think that that Socrates is, I mean, sometimes I get the sense, as you said with regard to your students, that he's being disingenuous when he's asking questions, that he somehow already knows the answer when he's asking the questions. Or is it the case that he genuinely is pursuing something that he himself recognizes he doesn't understand?
Yeah, I think it actually depends a lot on context, but I think quite often he is looking for a real answer to a real question. Mm-hmm. One of the questions that guides the Protagoras is the question, can virtue be taught? And Socrates says that seems to be a really hard thing to know. And if you look at the whole of the dialogue, the beginning and the end, there's sort of two parts that Socrates thinks are important to this question. One is, it does seem that virtue is related to knowledge, and if it's knowledge, well, wouldn't we be able to teach at least something about it? But on the other hand, we don't seem to find very many good teachers of excellence, of
right.
moral virtue, including really good fathers being unable to teach their own children, whom they're pretty invested in. So, you know, I think he's really wanting to look at perplexity, confusion, and to see that as a source of moving forward, mm-hmm. as opposed to something to be avoided.
Right, right. Well, I mean, there's one of the main contrasts that seems to be operating in the dialogue is this idea that, you know, questioning and answering is a kind of agonistic contest, mm-hmm. Which seems to be, or at least maybe correct me if I'm wrong, on your reading, this is sort of Protagoras' main approach. This is, like, I would assume, sort of the caricature of a sophist who is concerned about, you know, the question of who's won and who's lost. And so that's one thing. I think you're right that Socrates wants to shift the paradigm away from this agonistic, really rigorously competitive dimension, although there's mm-hmm. always that at stake or at play in the dialogue too, in a kind of fun way. So I mean, how do you understand Protagoras's attitude toward the winning, losing, or the agonistic dimension?
Right. So at one point, he's pretty clear that he cares about this. At one point, when Socrates and Protagoras are having a hard time moving the dialogue forward, Socrates says, "Listen, Protagoras, I want you to speak briefly now. You've had your long speech. Let's have you speak briefly." Right. And Protagoras says, "Socrates, listen, I've already undertaken many verbal contests, you know, the agonistic approach. Right. And if I had done as you demand and spoken as my antagonist demanded, mm-hmm. I would never have appeared to be the better, nor would Protagoras have become a name in Greece." Right. So, I mean, I think, and he's pretty open about it. I mean, I appreciate that about Protagoras, that he says, listen, you know, they have an audience there. We have a prospective pupil who's willing to pay money. Right. And he says, this is not going to be my strong point. Why should I take on emotive speech? It's not going to be good for me.
Right. And then, of course, Socrates then, you know, threatens to leave at that point, quite disingenuously, right, in a certain way. So there's an interesting real place there in the dialogue. This is, I think, your passage you were talking about is 335A and the following. Mm-hmm. And Socrates, it's clear that Socrates doesn't have somewhere else to go because he's telling a story to a friend. That's why we have this dialogue. But he says, okay, I'm out of here. I'm not going to hang around while you reel off the long speeches. So the dialogue is really threatened at that point, and I think that's something critical is happening there. I wonder, and this is going to, I mean, we're going to have to probably circle back to the question of questioning, because I want to think about this related to the issue of testing the person versus testing the idea. But let's stay at this passage for a second, because what I find kind of important is that, you know, here's an example where I think Protagoras is listening in some ways and saying, look, okay, you know, why should I proceed on your terms only? Why don't you allow me to talk the way I want to talk?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you see that? I mean, if Socrates is really insistent about, look, short answers, of course, he never listens to his own advice.
Long speeches. That's true. He gets the longest speech in the dialogue, longer than Protagoras's.
Yeah, same thing happens in the Gorgias, right? When, you know, and then he ends up talking and giving this kind of monologue. But even those monologues are kind of imagined dialogues, right? They're question and answer, and there's a pursuit of a kind of question. So maybe that's the core of this questioning. The importance of questioning.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this kind of tension always for Socrates between, on the one hand, saying there's a truth out there that I need to discover, that I don't simply create, you know, and that I need to be open to being transformed by that truth. And then on the other hand, this sense that, you know, to some extent, my language is going to fall short of being complete in describing that truth. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of dialogical movement that's always ongoing that I think is always open-ended. It's not really complete, except maybe in the Symposium where, you know, someone reaches the top of the ladder of love and they never want to come down again. But for the most part,
it's questionable as to whether that's been actually reached, right?
Right, right. I think that's a very good question about the Symposium. So the so there's a sort of ongoing tension always between neither saying, well, truth is something we merely create, you know, we just make it up, it's merely cultural, but also not saying, well, there's this sort of simple process that we can go through to reach the truth, and, you know, here, let's apply the principles and get to it, and then we'll be done.
Right.
And I think both are different kinds of temptations, and both are a kind of lack of humility, actually.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I really like what you've said here, and you said it really beautifully, I thought, in the book too, about the commitment to truth, this truth as a kind of transcendental ideal that is, you know, that Socrates is always striving for, but recognizes that he doesn't possess, and an openness to the questioning of our relation to that truth, and to recognize in this humble way, and that we may be falling short. One of the things I'm really interested in this project is the way appealing to the ideal of truth, the ideal of justice, is actually already a kind of turning toward that and a way of embodying it or weaving it into the community of relation that we have with one another and with the world. So what I'm wondering about is this transformative capacity of truth. You said, I think, to be open to being transformed by a relation to the truth. And is questioning, how is questioning related to that?
Right. So I think there's different ways people can question, right? And one way to question that Socrates seems to take pretty seriously is a mode of questioning where it's possible for me to change my ways of thinking, my categories, my way of understanding, say, the nature of justice, as a result of the questioning that I go through. I think, you know, one can be transformed in two senses, and I don't know if they're necessarily distinct acts, but transformed by the truth itself, by justice. I mean, he certainly seems to talk in certain ways about the need for the forms to affect us, you know, in various dialogues. But to be transformed by the other person that you're talking to, you know, see the other person's points and their claims as ones that might actually change your understanding. So, I mean, I think the big contrast today would be, look at most talk shows that you find on, you know, MSNBC, Fox News. Right. I don't think there's any real sense that people on either side have a genuine interest in seeing whether the other person will affect or change their views.
Right.
In fact, that it's much more agonistic.
Right.
And I think Socrates really does take seriously the possibility that I can be transformed by other people in the community, by my interlocutor, by justice itself.
Right. Well, I mean, I think you draw together, and maybe we could look at these passages briefly, draw together really nicely the two passages that seem, at least on the surface, to be in tension with one another. That is, the first passage, which is 331c5, where Socrates and Protagoras are talking, and Socrates said, Protagoras seems to just be going along with some of Socrates' answers and says, you know, answers in ways that say, well, if you like, or if that's what you want, I'll answer this way. And Socrates then stops everything and says, hold on, I've got no interest in investigating this if you like and if that's what you want kind of way. It's the
right.
real you and me I want to test. And what
right.
I mean by the real you and me is that I think the best way of testing out your claim would be if we left this if you like business out of it entirely. And then a few pages later, he seems to contradict himself, but actually I think you make the point that he really doesn't, which is at 333c, where Socrates says to Protagoras, it doesn't make any difference as long as you answer the questions. I don't mind whether you actually believe what you're saying or not. It's the idea itself I want to examine. Mind you, you and I, questioner and answerer, may also find ourselves being examined in the process. And I think that's the key last part of that.
Absolutely.
And that relates, I think, to what you're saying as the kind of relationship between the transformative possibility of the forms of the ideals and the questioning of one another. So how do we relate the questioning of one another to the question of the truth itself or justice itself to make that transformative in a way that has concrete social political implications?
Right. So there's a lot there. Let me just start with, you know, when Protagoras says, you know, the if you like,
right.
I didn't use this term in the book, but I think he's kind of passive aggressive there.
Uh-huh.
I think Protagoras is being a little bit passive aggressive because, I mean, I try to imagine you're talking to, a teenage son or daughter, nephew or niece, you know,
yeah.
and you ask them what their opinion is, and they simply responded, well, you know, if you want, Right. I'll be happy to stipulate that justice and holiness are similar.
Sure.
There's something very noncommittal about it, and it's a kind of refusal to engage authentically in the conversation at some level or another.
Right.
And I think Socrates, when he asked Protagoras to engage without stipulating, well, if you like, or whatever you want, Socrates, he does it out of a genuine care for Protagoras. He wants not only to know what is the answer to the question about justice or holiness, but he wants to know, he wants Protagoras there in this conversation with him.
Right.
He wants to see what they can learn together about this. And I think Socrates, as difficult as he can be, really responds to his interlocutors with a lot of care and engagement. And that relates to the idea of the transformative capacity, right? That Socrates wants Protagoras to be willing to be transformed. And you know, in some ways, too, Socrates isn't going to be transformed by a stipulated argument. He's going to be transformed by someone authentically saying, no, here's what I really believe and why.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are moments of that in the dialogue, but not enough of them.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one of the things we've talked a little bit about on this podcast already is the question of identity and what happens in digital media when you speak anonymously or articulate things from an anonymous perspective. And I think that's something that here we see Socrates saying, look, you know, in a certain way you have to anchor these questions and answers in the real commitments that you have as a person. And I think
you're
right to exactly point out on the cable news networks, and I think even in our political debates that we hear largely in coming out of Washington are not concerned about that, the transformative capacities, or they're not concerned about the true beliefs of individuals, but they're just, you know, ideologically driven.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I have some sympathy for why that's the case, which is to show any kind of weakness philosophically, or to say, well, we have a really huge problem in front of us, and we don't know how we'll fix the economy, you know, really is politically disastrous. I'm not sure that our system is, as a whole, amenable to it, not only at the highest levels, but, you know, are those of us who are voting for these representatives willing to let our candidates have weaknesses, you know, intellectually, morally, whatever. So, you know, and I think going back to that passage, 331C to D, you know, I think he really wants to say, let's look at you and me. You know, this idea of the ourselves, I think, jumps out at me in both passages. That there's not just a you and an I. There's not just a Protagoras and a Socrates in this passage. There's an ourselves that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that segues nicely into this question about listening, that, you know, when Socrates and Protagoras have this dialogue, it's not just one person speaking and then the other person speaking. I think Socrates highly values listening as a philosophical activity.
Yeah.
And I find that I think it's not something that's been paid ton of philosophical attention, you know, at least not compared to making good argument, being
right.
logical, soundness and validity of argument. What about listening as a philosophical activity?
Right. Well, you make a really, this is one of the things that really struck me from your book, which was one of the passages there. You emphasize that sympathetic listening involves putting oneself in the place of the other. And this is what I would call sort of ethical imagination, the ability to imagine one's way into the position of another, even if one doesn't ultimately agree with or take up those specific positions. And I think you're exactly right to highlight the importance of listening. Now you, and listening is sympathetically or attentively or imaginatively, highlight in the book in terms of talking about what listening is, it involves a kind of being receptive to what the other says and not necessarily agreeing. In the book, though, then you sort of just appeal to two examples. One is the discussion that Socrates has with Hippocrates,
mm-hmm.
when Hippocrates is listening to Socrates at the beginning, and he blushes when he realizes actually what he's suggesting is doing is going to try to be a sophist. And the other example of listening was this sort of funny scene at the doorway when Socrates and Hippocrates come to Callias's house, and the doorman says, you know, go away, we don't need any more sophists here. But my real my question about that is, I, after looking at your arguments, which I think are really compelling, and then rereading the Protagoras, I'm wondering if Protagoras isn't a better listener than you give him credit for being, in at least in the chapter that you have here. So I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I'll try to be a good listener. Okay. And say, where do you see him as listening well? You know, I am interested in what you're saying. Like, is what do you mean when you see him as listening well in the dialogue? Because I think there's different senses of listening, and I think probably he listens in some senses, but not so well in others. So,
well, that's fair enough. I mean, I would point to the sort of the end of the dialogue where, and I'm thinking now about 359 D and the following, where they're talking about, you know, bravery and cowardice, and here Socrates brings Protagoras back to the question of you. I want to know what you think. So if they had been talking about what the many think and trying to imagine right. what they think, which is also a very interesting point about listening, that Socrates is very basically imagining what the many think. So he's practicing that, he's cultivating that practice of sympathetic listening, I think, by just imagining what others might say. But then Protagoras goes and he says, where actually Socrates says, well, I'm asking you what you say the brave people go toward, things that are frightening, believing them to be frightening, rather than things that aren't frightening. And then Protagoras says, well, no, that can't be right. That was shown by your line of reasoning to be impossible just a moment ago, and then Socrates says, you're right again. So assuming that argument was correct, and we don't know whether that whole hedonism thing is something.
Right.
But so that, and then, I mean, in a certain way, I think you might say that Protagoras feels defeated at the end and kind of, you know, gives up everything. But he does say, you know, go ahead and finish off the discussion yourself. But there is a way in which I think Protagoras shows himself able to follow along with Socrates. Mm-hmm. He does respond with saying, look, even the example that you gave when they said, I don't really want to respond the way you want me to. That's an example of attentive listening, I think, in a certain way, and saying, look, you know,
right.
I know you want me to do this, but is this really the best way? And Socrates has to kind of justify himself.
Yeah, no, I think you make good points there, and I would definitely say he's more gracious than Callicles in the Gorgias, right? So if you want to talk about two failed conversations, this might be in Protagoras' favor. You know, in the Gorgias, for people who may not be familiar with it, Socrates ends up literally speaking to himself because Callicles is so enraged, he drops out of the argument, it all ends badly, you know. Right. And Protagoras, at least at the end, says, well, you know what, Socrates, you're pretty young, but I think someday you're going to be well known in Greece, yeah. You know?
I mean, do you take that as just your sort of begrudging compliment, or do you think he's there's an earnestness there?
You know, I'm optimistic about people, so I tend to read it as, you know, a kind of gracious, losing graciously,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
well, I think that's fair.
I agree with that, but I mean, again, of course, we now have couched it in winning and losing, but Socrates himself says, look, we've reversed places now, it seems like.
Yeah.
You know, it's this kind of interesting chiasmus that's happened where Socrates now is arguing that maybe virtue can't be taught, and Protagoras can be taught, and Protagoras seems to be arguing that maybe it can't. And I think that leaving us sort of there is really a powerful statement about the way dialogue, even if it remains somewhat open, can be transformative of both sides.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would say is I don't think Protagoras changes a whole lot in his understanding of their discussion as agonistic.
Mm-hmm.
So from the beginning to the end, whether he's a gracious loser or not, he still sees it as winning or losing. Whereas I think Socrates is not that concerned with it, although I might qualify that a little bit because he has Hippocrates there and is hoping Hippocrates won't, you know, sell his soul.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think Socrates is willing to engage with that genuine perplexity, aporia, mm-hmm. about whether virtue can be taught. And he even says to Protagoras, well, maybe, you know, we can continue this line of thought. And Protagoras essentially says, well, no, that's all right.
Right.
So, true. You know, so I think, I'm not sure how transformative it is of Protagoras. I imagine it's pretty transformative of Hippocrates, who's witnessing this all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the end of the dialogue, it says we left, you know,
right.
And you don't get Hippocrates's point of view, right. But
and also
it's
all the other people who are there. I mean, you've got Alcibiades,
right.
And all, and I mean,
right.
Basically the whole everybody who's at the symposium is there, plus a couple of other sophists. I mean, there's a lot of people there. There's a kind of a lot at stake. It really is an agonistic context.
Yeah, it is. And so then I guess what would be interesting to think about what, in what sense is winning or losing the battle for Socrates about himself, which I think for Protagoras it is about himself, and in what sense is it really about the other? I think for Socrates it really is about the other, you know, independently kind of having an intellectual conversion about what they're understanding of Protagoras' teaching,
right.
As opposed to how Socrates comes looking out of, you know, how does he look coming out of all this, so...
Well, I mean, I guess, so there's actually two related issues. One is, I wonder, and this is really is a question, and I mean, you've done a lot more work on the Protagoras than I have, but I worry that if we get a caricature of Protagoras as a sophist that's obsessed with winning, then we might lose something of the picture of Protagoras that we might get in the dialogue. I could be wrong about that, but I do worry that we always, as you started out with, we always set up this, you know, contrast, and we
put
it in Plato's, you know, philosophical writings that says, you know, well, you know, we got to combat the sophists are not philosophers, and philosophers have to distinguish ourselves from sophists. And I wonder what happens if we really would problematize that. I mean, there's a lot of work, mm-hmm. you point out in your book, a lot of work from rhetoricians who are arguing, you know, to try to retrieve Protagoras and all of this. But they also set up the philosopher then as this kind of straw man who's, you know, obsessed
right.
with, you know, rational truth and all the stuff. So I wonder if we could get away from that kind of dichotomy, if something other would open up in the dialogue. And then the other question that I have about it is, to what degree is a certain agonistic something naturally at play in discussions, and is that, and not necessarily of being a bad thing. I tend to think of it negatively. I hate the war, you know, images,
yeah,
the winning
yeah, yeah.
and the losing. I want to talk about, you know, the social dimensions that you draw out, the discovery and the cooperative activity.
Yeah. So two things there. I guess the first is, yeah, I think you're right. It needs to be problematized more than he's simply agonistic and Socrates isn't. And I guess on one side of that, you could even look at the middle of the dialogue or even where they enter the first scene of the dialogue
mm-hmm.
and Hippocrates and Socrates come to the door and the door is shut in their face and they come in again, you
right.
know, and then you see the sophists inside. Well, I mean, that seems to be a pretty clear allusion to Aristophanes' Clouds.
Uh-huh.
Where what happens, right? Strepsiades comes to the front door. The door is opened. It's slammed in his face.
Right.
He comes back in. There's the funny Socrates sitting in the basket trying to get closer to heaven.
Right.
You know? So now what does that mean? That Plato, on the one hand, you could say, well, he's putting Socrates outside the door and the sophists inside, right?
Right.
It might be a way of separating them. But on the other hand, here's Plato writing, reminding us, right, of Aristophanes' critique of Socrates
right.
as somebody sort of stuck inside the house, who's not in touch with reality, who's not, you know, really living a virtuous life as Aristophanes understands it.
Right.
So, you know, there's certainly the issue is being raised as to how different is Socrates from these sophists? Who's on what side of the door?
Right, right. I mean, and I really like the fact that you're highlighting the comic dimension, because we tend to think, I mean,
right.
the comic is throughout this dialogue, throughout Plato altogether, I think, and we tend to think of philosophy as this very serious, rigorous, rational endeavor, and, you know, what's great about Platonic writing is that it's playful, and Socrates's practice of conversation is playful. In fact, I can't remember the passage now. There's a place in the dialogue where Socrates responds in a very playful way to being critiqued and to being, in a certain sense, shamed by Protagoras. And his response is playful. It's not to, you know, lash out in anger, but it's okay. You know, if this is how we're going to play. And I think that there's an important aspect of playfulness as an excellence or as a virtue of dialogue that I think needs to be highlighted at some level, and I think that this dialogue does go some distance in that.
Yeah, and I think it is Plato both in one way revering his teacher and another way being willing to poke fun at him, you know, and you know, I think it comes out of a real respect. And again, going back to this question of humility, you know, that I think humility, you know, probably the best definition of humility I've heard is it's telling the truth about yourself. You know, it's not claiming that you're something that you are not, either better or worse than you really are. And I think he wants to look at, well, who is this ideal philosopher, and what, in what ways does he still kind of wonder about philosophy? Does he still kind of wonder about who Socrates was?
Right, right. No, there's no question about that. Well, I think we're going to have to end our conversation at that point, but I've really enjoyed this, Marina, and hopefully you'll be willing to join me again at maybe another point. Maybe we could talk about the Gorgias, or there may be some other things on the Pythagoras or other things to talk about. I've really enjoyed having you on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.